right?
Thank you.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is needed.
Please be seated. We have a couple of preliminary matters today. First of all, we are graced with the presence of students from Monroe High School, I'm told, and if that's the case, would they and their sponsors or teachers please stand? Very nice. Thank you very much. And we'd like to have you come and visit court with class. You may be seated. Now, it seems that we have, do we have any law students here? It's not on my list, but I see a number of people that look like they might fit that.
All those young people over here along the wall, they all look like law students.
No? Okay.
Could all young people stand up?
They have that.
Yeah, well, we're not.
That's what?
Yeah, that's right, compared to what?
Hey,
there you go.
They made the decision.
We may well be done with our argument before this occurs, but I want to remind you all now that we have a fire alarm that will occur at 11 o'clock. You don't need to leave. It's just a test, but it'll make you jump because it's really, really loud. So if you're still here, don't worry about it. Just we'll wait. Whatever we're doing, we'll all just wait until it's done making its noise, and then we'll proceed. So I've seen a little bit of the students with your standing. Now, the students are here on a program that we operate in coordination with the State Bar called Court with Class. So they have had some introduction to the cases we are going to argue today. And if you can come back after our second argument over the noon break, Justice Abrahamson will come out and talk with you a little bit about proceedings in the Supreme Court. Now, I'd like to introduce the court to all of you as well. On my far right, Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. Next to me, Justice Abrahamson, and she is the justice who will meet with you all. On my left, Justice Ian Walsh Bradley. On her left, Justice Michael Gableman. And on the far left, Justice Daniel Kelly. So, with those preliminaries, I think we are in good shape to begin with State versus Hager. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please, please proceed.
Assistant Attorney General Donald LaRocca appears on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. May it please the Court. In Ahrens, this Court interpreted the statutory standard that circuit courts apply in deciding whether a person who's been committed under Chapter 980 is entitled to a discharge trial. Act 84 amended the discharge petition review process. The state agrees with the Court of Appeals decision that Act 84 accomplished a material increase in a patient's burden of production for obtaining a discharge trial. But the state disagrees with the Court of Appeals' explanation as to how that works. In the court's decision, in both paragraphs 4 and 34, the Court of Appeals said, a circuit court must determine whether the facts in the record favorable to the petitioner establish a reasonable likelihood of success at an existing trial. The state's concern with that language is the focus of the use of the word favorable.
And Mr. LaRocca, one of the questions that kept running through my mind, and obviously this would be a good question for Mr. Hinkle as well, because it sort of serves as the central focus of both the briefs that have been submitted in this clash of the titans.
I saw that too.
Thank you, Mr. Balistrari.
All right. Anyway, moving on. The central focus that kept running through my mind was, we look at the language that the legislature chose, and they chose the word consider. And it makes sense that, you know, how else is a judge going to do it besides consider the most recent petition in light of the record that has been developed from the inception of the case, if that's what the legislature wants the judge to do? And so it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, or help illuminate my way if I'm on the right track, how do we help our circuit court judges to have the proper guidelines for what it means to consider, not favoring one side or the other, not weighing evidence, which is the sole province of the finder of fact, but to consider, and that's been the subject of some discussion in my chambers lately. What does to consider mean, and if I consider whether to take the 8 o'clock flight to Denver as opposed to the noon flight to Denver, am I necessarily weighing the benefits of such? And if I want to instruct and say a majority of the court wants to instruct the circuit court judges to follow the word that the legislature chose to use, consider, how would you recommend, Mr. Ladaraca, that we do that?
I think the court goes back to the language of the statute and what the court has to look at, and this is where the statute significantly changes from the prior statute that this court interpreted in Ahrens. It's focusing in, and we're focusing right now on 980.09 parens 2, that hearing, because I don't think there is much disagreement between the parties that the petition phase, the filing of the petition, is fairly straightforward. If there's something there that's offered, then the court should proceed to the next step, a determination. Now, that determination it's a changed process from the statute interpreted in Ahrens. The old statute, the court focused on, the court was to look at whether a trier of fact may conclude that there's information in that petition that would support discharge. That is, the person's no longer sexually violent. The new statute has very different language. First of all, it's not looking back at the petition once we're in phase two. It's asking the question, has the person's condition changed? And not just any change, but the word sufficiently qualifies the word change. So that's telling us something. It's not any change, but sufficiently changed. And it's no longer a may conclude standard, but a would likely conclude standard. And likely has meaning in Chapter 980. Likely is interpreted in 980.01 in the definition section to mean more likely than not. So if the court's tasked with assessing change, well, yes, obviously it needs to look at evidence favorable to the petitioner, the person seeking relief, when it decides the issue. But it needs a baseline to assess sufficient change. The sufficient change baseline is the last hearing at which a trier of fact considered evidence both favorable and unfavorable and decided that either the person met criteria for initial commitment or it could be a discharge trial where the court had to reprove that a person was still a sexually violent person. And so the court's question then gets to, well, what guidance can this court give to lower courts in how to do that? And the state has stepped back from the weighing position it's taken in this case and other cases, early cases litigating what the standard means. And we step back from weighing for two reasons. One, we go back to Ahrens and this court's most recent decision in Talley, and there's admonishments about not weighing because the statute itself doesn't use the word weigh. Number two, I think the danger of using the word weighing suggests credibility assessments. And the state is not suggesting that there should be any assessment of credibility in this phase two, except in the extremes. That is, if an opinion being offered in support of a discharge petition is based on facts or allegations that simply are not supported by the record, that would be an opinion built on a weak
Or the
weak
other
finding.
Example you, that was given in the briefs was by an expert who was demonstrably, by the record, unqualified to give an opinion.
That would be an example. Another would be, and this has occasionally happened, an expert applies a wrong legal standard. For example, applies a standard for a mental disease or defect under our insanity law when, in fact, 980 focuses and defines mental disorder, which is a different legal standard. So
counsel,
those would be situations in the extreme where a court would say, look, this opinion that's supporting discharge is built on such a weak foundation that it's not based on anything in the record. It's based on a misunderstanding of the law. But moving back now away from those exceptions.
So, counsel, on page 17 of your brief, you say, again, the reviewing court does not weigh any competing evidence. Rather, it must compare the new evidence with the previous evidence to assess whether it is likely the prior fact would reach a different result at a new trial. So what is the difference between weighing and comparing?
I think that's a fair question. We compare, and this is where the state looked at this following the Court of Appeals decision, and actually in planning for argument in the Court of Appeals, we looked at this and said, well, what we're being asked to do under the statute is decide whether someone sufficiently changed. That's a comparison. We tied back, and in our brief, to the newly discovered evidence case law. And we think that that makes sense, because in the world of newly discovered evidence, courts are not weighing. And the Edmonds decision suggests that the newly discovered evidence process is not a process of weighing, but rather asking whether the old evidence and the new evidence, looking at both of them, whether there's a reasonable probability that a fact finder would have a reasonable doubt as to the defendant's guilt. Now, that same standard can work in this context. We're, again, not weighing, assessing weight, but looking at the record and deciding, is this new information demonstrative of a change, sufficient change in the person's condition such that a jury would likely conclude the person's no longer.
All right, so tell me how this works in practice then. Let's say we have one expert who says there is a sufficient change in condition that a jury would not find him to be a sexually violent person. The state's expert says the opposite. This still is a sexually violent person. Here's my reasons why I think so. What is the court to do with those two opinions?
The court's to look at both evidence that either party offers, so it can consider that.
And if they are directly opposed, if the defendant's expert says A and the state's expert says not A on a particular fact, what is the court to do with that?
The court's supposed to go back and look at the underlying, at the original or the last commitment decision.
Right.
What's the record from that commitment decision say?
Right. So we've got that. So both experts are looking at that, and they're both trying to say, this defendant's witness is saying there's been a sufficient change, and the state's witness says there's not been a sufficient change. And they both look at the same piece of evidence, and the defendant's expert says this is true, the state's witness says it's not true. What does the court do with that?
In that case, I think there's an example of where a court has done that. In the Sugden case, which is cited in the state's reply brief, Sugden was actually a case where an individual was committed. Mr. Sugden was committed under the Chapter 980 law. After the commitment occurred, Mr. Sugden moved for relief on the grounds of newly discovered evidence, namely that there is new scientific data in these instruments that are often used, actuarial instruments that are used in these commitment cases.
Was it newly discovered evidence? Is that what he based it on?
That's what the Court of Appeals based its decision on. And in fact, what the court said in this context, the inquiry is whether there is a reasonable probability the jury, looking at both the old evidence and the new evidence, would have a reasonable doubt that Sugden met the standards for commitment as a sexually violent person.
Okay. Now, that seems to be, and we can get into this a little bit later, that's a difference in kind in what we're asking about what a jury might do. Right? So here, we're asking whether the evidence is such that a reasonable jury would be likely to find that this person is no longer a sexually violent person. So let me try to back into my prior question this way. When you're moving from whether a jury could find that this person is not a sexually violent person, you're talking about a sufficiency of the evidence question. Is this enough to go to the jury for its consideration? When you move to, is it more likely than not that a jury would find this person not to be a sexually violent person? Now you're moving into the realm of permission. So it's away from permission to prediction, right? So the sufficiency of evidence is a question of permission. Can the jury find no sexually violent person? Now it's we're going to predict whether a jury, looking at all of the evidence, would find the person is not sexually violent. How does that not require weighing of evidence?
Because it doesn't involve weighing in the sense of making credibility assessments.
Okay, let's put credibility to a side. And we say, you know, expert A says, you know, proposition one is true. Expert B says proposition one is not true. What do you do with that?
In the case of a person seeking discharge, I think the court needs to look at that evidence that supports the discharge petition. And it looks at the other expert's report in this way. That is, it can be used, and the Court of Appeals suggested this, it can be used to support, it could be, the expert report offered by the state could be used in this context to demonstrate that this new expert's opinion is based on old information that was already part of the record.
Okay, that's a question of whether the evidence should be considered at all. Let's say that there is evidence that's coming in, it's new, and one expert finds this significant to a conclusion that the person is no longer sexually violent, and the other expert says, no, he still is, based on the same evidence.
The state in this situation would say, in that situation where there's equal, it still has to go back to the original commitment trial and ask whether sufficient change, and assuming it does that, the court should be focusing on the information that's proffered from the person seeking relief.
Okay, so if you're right, if you were to write this opinion, would you say, if I understand your position correctly, that the court is to only look at evidence in support of the petitioner's position?
No, because the court has to look at the original, the last most recent event at which a person's condition was assessed.
I understand. That's just a question of the baseline against which we're comparing things. But if we have competing analyses about what the difference means, would you say that it is the court's responsibility to only look at the analyses that support the petition as opposed to the analyses that do not support it?
It's the state's position that the court should be looking at both.
And if they are in conflict, how do they resolve the conflict?
Doesn't it sort of depend, Justice Kelly, on what the full record looks like? I think that's what he's trying to explain, and your hypothetical is interesting, but it's going to change for every single case.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear the lawyer answer the question.
Well, I'm trying to figure out where we're going with this. We've been going for quite a while. Some of us have some questions,
okay,
too.
Okay. I don't think I've gotten an answer, but...
Let me then, if I may, the question then is considering the record and the question that was being explored, for what purpose do we consider the record? Why consider the record? in paragraph 20 of the Carter decision, which explains what happened in Hager, it says this. In Hager, the court said, why do we review the record? If you want to grab it, you can. It's pretty unexciting.
If I may just interrupt for a minute, is counsel for Carter here? That's an afternoon case. No, okay. Unfortunately, the
Len Kaczynski
should have been in the morning together, but they're not.
It matters not, I think.
Right.
Okay. The record, it says this. What's the record review for? And it refers to paragraphs 41 and 43 of the Hager Court of Appeals decision. And Carter Court says, this is what Hager stands for. The record review under 980.92 is primarily designed to ensure that the petition alleges new and probative, i.e. reliable, like you were discussing before, information that has not been presented to a fact finder. Do you agree with that?
Yes, in fact, I actually believe that the explanation in Carter of what it did in Hager is a cleaner explanation.
So the purpose of comparing, you are advancing, is not to, for purposes of saying who's right or who's wrong, or comparing the yin and the yang and the record.
I got it.
Okay, I'm glad you did that. I'm sure Rebecca did. But rather, comparing only for purposes of, is it new? And we can only know if this is new information if we look at the old information.
Correct.
Okay. Is that your argument? I didn't think you were arguing that. I thought you disagreed with that which is set forth in paragraphs 41 and 42 of the Court of Appeals decision in this case, in Hager, and that was the summary in paragraph 20 of Carter of what was said in 41 and 42. So I'm a bit at a loss.
Well, it goes back to, as we argued in our reply brief here, we looked at how the court dealt with it in Sugden, which is a newly discovered evidence case, and it's looking at that old evidence and the new evidence. Sugden was new evidence offered in support of the idea that the person was no longer sexually violent. And the question that the circuit court went through and analyzed was whether the prior fact would have a reasonable doubt as to whether the person met criteria or met the standard for commitment.
Except newly discovered evidence is a different doctrine, if you will, than what we're talking about here. Newly discovered evidence for purposes of getting withdrawal of plea or whatever, I mean, has finality as its prime goal, and we don't have that here, I would hope, because if incarceration or commitment, whatever you call it, is final, then we got a problem with the very foundations of Post and Carpenter, which started
so
this.
If I understand, go ahead, Justice.
Go, please. Please.
You go ahead. The Court of Appeals undertook essentially a de novo review of the sufficiency of the evidence in the court's initial decision making regarding whether or not this should be set for a hearing. I may be an advantage or a disadvantage because I bet I've had more 980s than everyone on the bench combined. And when these documents come into the court, it's been my experience that what happens is if the defense doesn't have an expert opinion that would support it, they generally withdraw their petition or don't ask the court to proceed further because they don't have anything to support the petition. So you only have this scenario before the court when there are competing expert opinions. I guess it's possible, but it's just doesn't
well,
go
actually,
too far otherwise.
No, actually, it is possible that the Department of Health Services may actually...
I've had that experience where the state's expert determines the person is no longer... I think I've had almost every experience you could have in a 980, actually. Having said that, There has to be. Well, Aaron's was my case underlying. I mean, that's why I didn't sit on it, for example. Having said that, not the part that came up here, but the initial commitment. Having said that, there has to be an initial sort of determination, and I think that's what the legislature is trying to put into words. When does a court set something for a hearing, and when don't they? And what is the standard that we apply there? Part of what I'm concerned with is, what's the standard on review when these come up to the Court of Appeals? Is it a de novo review, like a sufficiency of the evidence? I mean, I think the court sometimes mixes up credibility of witnesses, credibility of reports, versus has it met the standard by which a jury or a court could conclude that this person no longer is a sexually violent person subject to commitment. Those are slightly different things. What is the standard the court should use when first determining whether to even hold the hearing?
You mean the circuit court?
Yes. And then what is the standard on appeal?
The circuit court, in deciding whether to hold a hearing, basically is the language of the statute says may hold a hearing in paragraph 2. But it makes that decision based on what's in that petition. And that petition, what the court does when it reviews the initial petition is decide, does it state anything? If a person, and oftentimes these are pro se petitions, the petition will state, I'm no longer disordered. Well, that's not sufficient. But assuming we get past that because there's an evidence report attached to it that supports things, then I think that's enough for the court to look at that, the information that's offered in the petition, and then look at and compare it to decide whether the person's condition has sufficiently changed. That's what the court's supposed to do. And so,
but what Justice Kelly was getting at is, when does that second step rise to the level of actually having the discharge hearing, not the initial review? I mean, you get that if you have, the court has to look at this, but there has to be some standard by which the court decides, yes, this one goes to a full hearing, this one doesn't.
And that's where the court makes that comparison, because it has to decide, has someone sufficiently changed such that a fact finder would likely conclude that the person's no longer sexually violent?
Someone has sufficiently changed. That's what the court has to decide. Isn't that a comparing of the evidence? That isn't that really a weighing of the evidence?
It's a comparison. But we don't call it weighing, for example, when we're looking at old and new evidence in the other context that the state's analogous.
Yeah. Now you're, if I may, I don't know, Annette, are you done? Now you seem to be flip-flopping, with all due respect. What is being weighed, compared, or considered here? Is it, as was set forth in Hager and Carter, the record review under 980.092 is designed to ensure that the petition alleges new and probative information that has not yet been presented? That is this new? Or is it that there is a change in the condition such that he is no longer, or she is no longer, fits the criteria for a sexually violent person?
My time is...
Yes, you can answer the question. Thank you.
It's looking at whether this is new information, because it has to decide if there's change. That's what it's doing. It's basically looking at this information offered in support of the petition and deciding whether... first question, is it new? And then the next question is whether or not it changes the outlook on the case.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Andrew Hinkle from the Public Defender for Mr. Hager. And may it please the court, as has sometimes been the case in the course of this litigation, I'm not entirely sure where our dispute lies anymore. So I think I'll just start
Well, you both asked for the Court of Appeals to be reversed.
That's true.
And you both asked that...
Oh, I'm sorry.
No,
I don't ask the Court of Appeals to be reversed.
No, he likes the decision.
Yeah.
The
but...
Oh, you're agreeable this morning. Yeah. Be careful.
But you say that... Well, go ahead. You want this court to, this is on page 22 of your brief, respectfully request that the court reverse the circuit's court order denying his petition and remand with directions that the court hold a discharge trial, right?
Correct. Okay. Effectively affirming the Court of Appeals.
Right.
I believe the Court of Appeals' opinion to be right in essentially all respects.
Mr. Henkel, the thought occurs as I listen to the argument today and as I consider all the briefs. Perhaps we are all making just a bit too much of this, and we are all thinking about it just a little too hard. Let me illustrate what I mean. Somewhere along the line, someone used the analogy, and I can't remember where it is, of when a court receives a motion for an order to dismiss a criminal complaint based upon the state's failure to state a claim because it hasn't sufficiently alleged facts that would support all the elements. I don't think anyone brought this up, but on the other end of the trial would be a judgment notwithstanding the verdict, where a motion is made at the conclusion of all the evidence, and one party would move for a directed verdict. In both instances, our trial courts are called upon to consider all of the evidence and refrain from weighing it because I, like someone else expressed, I think a couple of my colleagues have expressed, when I hear the word weigh evidence, that does call for a consideration, if not of the credibility itself, it certainly calls, it calls for what weight to assign. After we get past the hurdle of admissibility, we get to the question of what weight to assign the admitted evidence, and that is something reserved to the exclusive province of the finder of fact. So I wonder if a workable definition, one that would be in line with what the legislature intended with the use of its word consider, would not be something that we could analogize and therefore use some of the language when helping to guide and instruct our circuit courts, wouldn't be those two instances which I started my lengthy question with, to say when you consider the same way you consider in those two instances, simply whether everything that has been offered rises to the standard that the movement, here it would be the petitioner, even though the state has the ultimate burden of proof, the petitioner, of course, must make the initial showing, has met his or her burden. Is that something that you would think would be in line with the legislative directive?
I would be in agreement so long as we're discussing a burden of production. My concern about the state's position and its argument about newly discovered evidence is what it in fact amounts to.
Wait,
is a burden
wait.
Of
I'm not talking about newly discovered evidence, but I want to hear your concern. You said I'm in agreement so long as, and then you said something about...
I'm sorry, we're talking about a burden of production rather than a burden of persuasion. That is to say, right. We're not... I think I'm essentially agreeing with what you're saying, and it's much like what you said in Ahrens. I think what the legislature did with this amendment was essentially raise the bar just a little bit for how convincing the petitioner's evidence needs to be, and I think that's all that they did.
And that's what? I'm sorry.
All that they did. That's the only effective change that the legislature made, was to raise the bar on the burden of production, not to alter, as the state has argued, the overall analysis of how we look at different evidence. To answer your question from earlier, and I think it's sort of entwined in this question as well, you asked what it means, what the legislature is asking a circuit court to do when it says that you can consider X, Y, and Z documents. First, I point out that what the statute says is may consider. It doesn't require consideration of all of those things. And in my view, I think there are a few different legitimate considerations, I suppose. One is, as has been stated, I think, a few times from the bench today, we need to know what the old evidence was, the old situation was, in order to know whether what's being proffered is truly new. Another thing that, for example, a state's report, an unfavorable report to the petitioner might be useful for, is simply for learning the facts of a case. These are frequently multi-day jury trials. And I think, I imagine it's fairly common practice on the circuit courts to not literally read the entire record from all of the 980 proceedings that have gone before, maybe 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, but to try and get a handle on the facts of the case as they are presented by the experts, and that can be include the state's experts. So, again, my position is simply that, of course you consider all of these items, because you have to understand the context of the case to understand the meaning of the petition, the meaning of the facts presented by the petitioner. That does not mean, as has sort of been the central issue in this case, that does not mean that you can look at the items presented by the petitioner and say, well, yeah, their expert says he's only 15% likely to recidivate, but the state's expert says 60%, so I kind of believe that the state's expert, therefore no trial. As Justice Gableman has pointed out, that's a decision that's reserved for the finder of fact.
But isn't it more likely that what you're going to have is experts who, they don't just rely on an opinion about whether he is more likely to be committing future acts of sexual violence, but to look on what were the motivating factors, what showed those characteristics in the past, and are there facts showing that those kind of characteristics in him have changed, and how have they changed?
That's certainly one category of evidence that's presented in these things, although in my experience, I'll say, very frequently the main disputes come down to these actuarial instruments, which don't necessarily involve, in fact, they most typically do not at all involve a sort of logical look at, you know, this is what he was like then, this is what caused him to do what he did, and this is how things have changed. Very often, the factors that are present in those actuarial instruments, we don't know why they're connected with recidivism. We just know that they are. And really, that's often the beginning and the end of these cases, is disputes about which actuarial instruments are appropriate and how to interpret them. So I would agree, and I think in Mr. Hager's case, we actually have in Wakefield's report descriptions of how he has actually changed since 2008 when he was first locked up. And I think that in itself would support his right to a trial here. But I also believe that the changes in the actuarial instruments, I have a hard time saying that word, independently would support his right to a trial.
Counsel, the new version of Section 980.09 directs the court to determine whether a court or jury would likely conclude the person no longer meets the criteria for commitment as a sexually violent person. Doesn't the requirement that the court look at what a court or jury would more likely conclude, doesn't that require some prediction on what a reasonable jury might do?
So I need to answer this question carefully, because the statute sort of describes the inquiry several times just within that one section.
Four times, correct.
Up front, it says what you said. I think you were essentially reading a quote from that. And that's in the first sentence, which is about how the court looks at the petition. The second sentence is about what materials the court may consider. And in my view, that description of what the court's ultimate task is simply a shorthand, which is described more fully at the end of the statute, where it says, It gives sort of a binary decision. It says, if the court determines that the record contains facts from which a court or jury would likely conclude the person no longer meets the criteria, the court shall set the matter for trial. Now, and that's where, I think that's where the court's decision in Ahrens came from, that phrase contains facts, which essentially would bring about this decision in a fact finder. It doesn't say the record as a whole determines that person no longer.
Right. So is it your position then that the court is to look only at those facts that are favorable to the petitioner?
I wouldn't say the court is only to look at such facts as we've been discussing. I think the court must consider.
They can look at anything, but they are only in making their decision about what a jury would likely do. They can only put into that analytical construct the facts that are supportive of the petitioner.
Yes, I would agree with that statement.
How can you determine then that there's been a change if you're only going to look at what's in the petition or other factors that are favorable to the defendant? I mean, to the committee.
Once again, I'm trying to draw a distinction between considering, that is, as you suggested, you know, 30 is different than 50, right? And we can't know that it was 50 without considering the prior trial or whatever. Wherever we are procedurally.
I guess maybe that's because I'm more concerned with the facts rather than with a percentage that tends to incorporate what the professional thinks the underlying facts show.
Well, sure, I would agree with that. I think, so for example, again, in this case, we have Mr. Hager and his various sort of reforms and attitude, the treatment that he's taken and the effects that it's had.
Right.
The only way to know that that's a change is to know what he was like before.
Right, right.
My disagreement with the state is that when we talk about things like the newly discovered evidence standard, it's simply false to say that doesn't involve weighing of the evidence. That cite to whatever case it is, it's factually sort of an odd case. Obviously, a court, when deciding whether some new evidence that's presented would change a jury's mind, is going to be looking at the strength of that evidence and the strength of the evidence presented at trial. There's simply no way to do that without weighing. The reason we don't grant a new trial when a witness, sort of a collateral sort of witness recants and there's DNA evidence everywhere is because DNA evidence is much, much stronger and it just doesn't make much of a difference if that witness recanted. And when the state actually describes the inquiry that it's talking about in their newly discovered evidence, it says, compare the new evidence with the old evidence to assess how a jury would probably decide a new trial with the new evidence added to the evidence that they heard previously. I mean, that's the definition of weighing the evidence. It's like saying, I'm not making a peanut butter sandwich, I'm just taking two slices of bread and spreading peanut butter on one half and jelly on the other and putting them together. What you're doing is making the peanut butter and jelly sandwich, whether you allow that or not. And what the state is doing is proposing a test whereby they get to point at all the old evidence and say, hey, this new evidence just doesn't change the picture enough.
So what's your stand? What do you suggest this court do? How would you write this opinion?
I think the legal holding in this case ought to be that as in Ahrens, a court is directed, the inquiry that a circuit court is to conduct is to look at the evidence presented by the petitioner, to look at all of the other evidence in the record, and ultimately to say, is there evidence of a change in the petitioner? Is there evidence from which a jury would likely conclude that the petitioner no longer meets the conditions for continued confinement?
So are they weighing all this evidence?
No.
Are they making the decision of whether or not there's a discharge or a discharge hearing?
I'm sorry, I don't understand
the
question.
Okay. What the legal holding is what you want, Ahrens, right? And that's what you, in effect, say on page 14 of your brief.
Yeah, I believe that Ahrens remains the law. Ahrens remains the law with the exception of, again, a slight increase in the burden of production. I think I made reference to the Iqbal standard from the United States Supreme Court case having to do with civil procedure, but I think that provides, it actually lines up nicely with the language of the statute, and it provides sort of a sense of, well, the evidence that is presented needs to be not simply something that marginally suggests that the person has changed and no longer meets the commitment, but something that you can look at and with confidence say, hey, you know, if this is credited, he should be let out. And I think we amply have that here. And I think, you know, the state throughout the course of this litigation, has not been wanting to talk about the facts in this case. And I think here in the Supreme Court, one of the reasons that they don't want to talk about the facts in this case is because explaining how they apply to Mr. Hager would make very clear that what we're talking about is weighing. There's no way that you can make an argument that he's not entitled to a discharge trial without saying that the Allen report is simply more credible than the Wakefield report or something along those lines.
You know, nobody gave us the petition in the appendices. So we don't know what the petition looks like, and that we went back and went all the way through the record and pulled out the petition. I would suggest that it's always helpful to give the petition, even though you may both agree on what you think the petition shows, it's still helpful to the court.
Well, sorry for that oversight. I thought that I included the Wakefield report, but perhaps I didn't.
I didn't see the petition. That's what I was looking for.
The petition itself is simply a one-page form, sort of as a checkbox, and it's the Wakefield report that's attached to it. But I do apologize if it made the court's task more difficult.
It's just you know it's a one-page form.
That's right.
That's true. Just to say your hands.
Mr. Henkel, you...
I'm sorry, but I didn't get marked down on my sheet. I asked you what is the legal holding that you would like this court to do, and you said, as in Aaron's, with a slight increase in the burden of production.
Right.
So that the trial court is to look at the petition as evidence and all the record, and then say, is there evidence that the jury... Would you finish that?
From which the jury or judge, as these can be bench trials,
from which
could
the fact
or would
finder.
Like to conclude that the person no longer meets the criteria for confinement.
Right.
So... normally dislike hypothetical questions, but the holding that you've suggested raises kind of the hypothetical question that Mr. LaDaraca, during his presentation, sort of rhetorically asked, and that is, it was prefaced by his observation that most of these, or many of these petitions are done pro se, and one comes in that's written by the petitioner and says, I no longer fit the criteria, and I'm no longer a threat. Whatever, I don't remember what the magic words. But so that comes in, and the court receives it and considers that, and considers it in light of the record, but does not weigh it, does not consider what weight to assign it, but according to what you just said, if believed, but then I guess that goes to whether a qualified expert has rendered and that goes to the doorkeeper, the gatekeeper function of the court.
Right. I mean, I think a conclusory statement like that, I don't think that you necessarily have to get into weighting credibility in order to say, listen, your opinion that you shouldn't be locked up anymore is not evidence from which a fact finder would likely conclude that you shouldn't be locked up anymore.
Because it runs to the... Are you agreeing that that would run more to the gatekeeper function of the circuit court to say that's not...
Yes, I would say that doesn't clear the hurdle that I'm talking about.
Right. Okay.
Because it's not reliable, really. That's the phrase one of you used in your petition. You know, it's akin to the gatekeeper function. I don't want to get into Daubert, but...
It's not exactly right.
The pre-Daubert sort of...
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yes. So is your understanding of the state's position, since you've got some green light here, your understanding of the state's position is that it says the amendment in 2013 superseded Aaron's. You're embracing Aaron's, and what's your understanding of what they mean by superseding vis-a-vis whether or not Aaron's is still good law?
I mean, I think ultimately the state's position is quite contrary to Aaron's. What they're explicitly asking, in fact, is for a new, or at least have been asking for, is a new method of analysis by which the court is to, for lack of a better word, consider other evidence in the record in a way that it can defeat favorable evidence to the petitioner. And that's directly contrary to several statements in Aarons. And I believe that those statements in Aarons, which were based on the fact that, hey, the statute doesn't say burden of proof, the statute doesn't say probable cause, the statute doesn't say preponderance of the evidence, all of those things are still true. I think Aarons remains essentially the law with, again, the caveat that the legislature has raised the burden of production a little bit, sort of changed the quality of evidence that needs to be presented. I'm happy to talk about the constitutional issue that arises if we start imposing a burden of proof on a person in order to get a discharge.
You do have a constitutional argument. We really don't see it here. The Court of Appeals kind of tucked it away. So explain, and it said we need not address because we say there is no weighing. So maybe you could explain your constitutional argument and if it is contingent upon the permitting weighing.
I would agree with the Court of Appeals statement. If this court holds, as I'm asking it to hold, with regard to what the statute means, then there's no constitutional problem. The state, I'm in agreement with what the state says, that there's no constitutional problem in imposing a burden of production on someone in order to get a discharge trial. The problem arises if we start to put a burden of persuasion on the person in order to get a discharge trial. That is, essentially convince a judge, my evidence is better than the state's evidence, and therefore you should give me a trial where they try to prove that their evidence is better than my evidence. The reason that that's not permissible is that in Addington versus Texas, the United States Supreme Court has held that for a mental commitment, the obligation always has to be on the petitioner, or we'll say the state here, to prove, not merely to prove that the person is mentally ill and dangerous, but to prove that by clear and convincing evidence, or some similar phrase. That is, it's a constitutional requirement that the person not carry the burden to show that they are not dangerous or not mentally ill. And the court reiterated that in Fouché, in which it said again, and that was a case in which the person was confined and was seeking to get out, and the state was saying, listen, we don't have to let you out because we think you're still dangerous. But the Supreme Court reversed the court's holding that he could remain confined, saying, the state can't do this without carrying a burden. The burden has to remain on the state to show that this person remains a proper subject for commitment.
Doesn't the burden remain on the state under the terms of this statute? That is to say, isn't the analysis performed against the clear and convincing standard of proof, such that you get a discharge trial if you demonstrate to the courts that your evidence would be sufficient to defeat the state's ability to prove with clear and convincing evidence that the person is still a sexually violent person.
So, Justice Kelly, that's a position that the state sort of somewhat advanced in the Court of Appeals. First of all, I don't agree as a practical matter that's an inquiry that a judge is able to conduct in a sensible way, to say, hey, unless they're simply having a trial before the trial and saying, listen, I've looked at every single piece of evidence and I believe that the state could show by clear and convincing evidence that you remain a danger. You've just had the trial that we're arguing about whether or not you should have. So I don't know that it answers the constitutional issue, but I don't see it as, first of all, I don't see it as procedure that's imposed by the statute, and second of all, I don't see it as a terribly workable alternative.
As I understand it in a simple way, your argument is, and then correct me if I'm wrong or add nuance to my simplicity, if weighing is allowed, that transforms the burden of production to a burden of persuasion. And the defendant does not carry a burden of persuasion, only the state does.
That would be my position. I think we use weighing a lot as a shorthand because it's easy to say. But the problem with it, the constitutional problem with it, is that what it actually connotes in real life is going to be placing a burden of persuasion on the petitioner to show that they should not be confined. I believe I've covered essentially everything that I wanted to say, so if there are no further questions from the bench, I'll just add that I think that the Court of Appeals decision was correct in its entirety, and that Mr. Hager is clearly entitled to a discharge trial, and that this court should grant him one.
Very good.
Thank you.
Briefly, counsel referenced the Iqbal case, which deals with the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. That case incorporates a plausibility standard. When 980 was first enacted, the standard by which someone got a discharge trial was a probable cause. Plausibility and probable cause are comparable concepts, and the state, and that's not what the statute says. So I think the state's position is that we shouldn't be looking at Federal Rules of Civil Procedure for guidance here, because it's not really a question of plausibility or probable cause. We've rejected that, or the legislature rejected that, when it changed the language to may conclude and then changed it to again to what would likely conclude.
Do you want to overrule Aaron's? Do you want to overrule Aaron's?
I don't know. As my colleague, Mr. Ballastieri, said, that Aaron's isn't, it's not about overruling Aarons. The legislature wrote a changed the statute.
Is Aarons still good law with the caveat that the burden of production under the 2013 amendment has been made greater?
That's not the only change to the statute since Aarons. There are other changes.
Oh, I know the changes. Is Aarons still good law? But for that caveat, that one caveat.
I don't believe it's still good law. And for example, in Aaron's, one of the reasons this court remanded the case back to circuit court for review, it remanded it back for two reasons. One, the court didn't apply the correct legal standard, and it wanted the court to apply the correct, proper legal standard based on its review of the record. But two, more importantly, when this court remanded it back, it noted that the circuit court didn't comply with the statutory directive to look at all of the shall consider all of the evidence in the record going back to the initial commitment. This case, the statute now has removed the shall requirement, and it uses a different look-back period. And that it expressly says that look-back period is the most recent event where fact-finding occurred on whether the person had a disorder and that disorder predisposed him to engage in acts of sexual
violence. Do you agree with that part of Aaron's, which likens sub 1 of the statute previously and arguably now to an inquiry akin to whether or not the petition sets forth a claim upon which relief can be granted?
The state would agree that that's an appropriate way for the judge to review that initial petition.
It was in Aaron's, and it still is.
It is, except there's language in there that it's moved the bar from may conclude to would likely conclude.
Yes, I understand and have looked at several times every word that's been changed in 2013, but I'm inquiring about the effect. And is it your position that with regard to sub 1, the analytical framework is akin to whether or not if the petition sets forth a claim upon which relief can be granted? That's akin to that.
Under parens 1, yes.
And is that sub 1 met here in this case?
The state would agree that sub 1 was met because the petition, as I understand it, incorporated the report of Ms. Holliday Wakefield, who was appointed to assist Mr. Hager when the annual reexamination occurred.
Would a report that is considered a reliable report, a la the gatekeeper function, is attached to a petition, does that automatically mean that sub 1 has been complied with?
Generally, in my experience litigating these cases in the circuit court, I would, when such a report was attached and incorporated into a petition, whether it was prepared by a private expert or the Department of Health Services, I would typically say that that was enough. And in fact, in this case, when I was actually involved in Mr. Hager's case before the new statutory change, that's what happened. We looked at the report that was attached to a petition. Not only did we agree that it met one, it met two, and then Mr. Hager withdrew his request for a trial.
Mm-hmm. You started your argument this morning of, if there is something there, and I inserted in sub one, and if it's offered, then the court should proceed to the next step, and that's generally your position.
That's correct. It should be doing that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you both for an interesting case and for very good arguments. We're going to take a brief recess because the students who are here will be leaving in another 15 minutes. So we will